A Hong Kong court has sentenced Catholic businessman and democracy advocate Jimmy Lai to 20 years in prison for what the Chinese government is calling sedition. Jimmy's son, Sebastian Lai, is here with an update. Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen's cause for canonization has finally advanced with the announcement of a long-awaited beatification. Executive Director of the Sheen Foundation, Monsignor Jason Gray, and a member of the Sheen family are here with the latest. And the U.S. Department of Justice is launching an investigation into recent vandalism at a church in California. Why are these incidents on the rise, and what is the DOJ prepared to do to protect religious freedom? Assistant U.S. Attorney General Harmeet Dhillon is here to tell us. And my chat with Hollywood legend and producer Kelsey Grammer about a very special project, Bernadette, the musical. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over as we celebrate our 30th year. We have an important show for you tonight. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. And you can always find us on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show. Wonderful programs there this week. This week, a Beijing-backed court in Hong Kong sentenced Catholic media magnate and democracy icon Jimmy Lai to 20 years in prison. Now, this is the harshest sentence ever handed down under China's national security law. Lai is 78 years old. He's suffering from heart disease, diabetes, failing eyesight, and he has spent 5 years largely in solitary confinement. Here tonight with reaction, Jimmy's son, Sebastian Lai, and President Emeritus of the Acton Institute, Father Robert Sirico. Gentlemen, I'm so glad you're here and gave us the time. Sebastian, I want to start with you. Three of these CCP-vetted judges handed your father's sentence down, 20 years in prison. A man who, even as the sentence was read out, he was smiling and put his hands together to greet those watching from the gallery. What was going through your mind when you saw that moment, and what did that smile mean to you?
It really meant the world. I know it's a little sign, but it's a sign that my father is still fighting. That, you know, I think a lot of people in the situation that he's in, facing these horrible odds, in solitary confinement for the last 5 years, at his age, given his health deterioration, would feel despair. But I think he's a man who knows that he did the right thing at every turn. He's a man who, as he said, could have left and lived comfortably, but decided to stay and live meaningfully and protect his journalist. And I think that smile says it all. It says that, you know, you might have shackled my body, but you have not shackled my spirit and you have not shackled my faith.
Sebastian, your sister Claire was with you at the press conference earlier this week, and she put it very starkly there.
The life expectancy of the average male in Hong Kong is 83. My father was handed a 20-year sentence. He is 5 years from 83. I mean, just looking at this objectively, this has to be solved.
Sebastian, given what you know about his condition now, no sunlight, no access to the Eucharist at times, heart problems, diabetes, what condition is he in at this moment?
It's absolutely horrible. I mean, everybody knows someone who is around the age of my father, who's in the late 70s, early 80s. Imagine that person, and no matter how strong they are, put them in a little cell, 60 square feet, with no natural light, in solitary confinement, no contact with anybody. If you do that for 100 days, even 100 days, I don't think the odds of survival are very high. And he's been in those conditions for 1,800. It's absolutely inhumane, and it's worse than actual criminals. And it's an attempt to break him. It's an attempt to break this very courageous man.
Yeah. Father, you've known Jimmy Lai for 25 years. And I mean, just to acquaint people who may not be totally familiar with the story, he was running what is essentially the New York Times of Hong Kong, Apple Daily. They shut down the paper. They fire all of his staff, shutter everything. because of the democracy protests that they were covering.
So that's all before the trial, mind you.
Right. Before the national security law was passed, right?
Right.
So they retroactively charged him with a law that hadn't been on the books yet.
Exactly.
He stayed in the country, as Sebastian said, to defend his journalists and to defend his honor and his right to speak his mind as a Hong Kong citizen. You met him there in 1998. I know Bill introduced you to Jimmy Lai in 1998,
yes.
Father. And he was, of course, Jimmy's godfather. Now comes this sentence. As a priest, as a friend, what was your reaction when you heard this verdict?
Well, I mean, it wasn't a surprise, let's put it that way, but you can call it 20 years, but you've already established the fact that this really is a life sentence. This is what communists do. And I think Sebastian is very right to underscore that they have not been able to even dent this man's confidence and sense of transcendent morality in facing this. And he's doing it not just for himself, but for the other defendants in this case, and indeed for the Chinese people, for those in Hong Kong and the Chinese people on the mainland, because this is an issue that has to be dealt with at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Father, you testified before Congress, the Executive Committee on China, in 2023, and you asked, when was the last time you saw a totalitarian government put someone through their court system and have them come out innocent? I mean, does this sentence hit harder, though? I mean, yes, we expected it, but is it worse than you expected at this point? I thought they might release Jimmy just because of the international pressure and attention.
I don't know what Sebastian thinks. I never thought for a moment they were going to release him. Not for one single moment. I mean, I'm hopeful that he will be released, which is different than the communists releasing him of their own volition.
Right.
I think that may come through negotiations, I didn't think they would do that.
Sebastian, President Trump has a planned visit in April to Beijing. You said that your father's case is a litmus test for any engagement we have with China. What do you mean by that?
I mean that if we, you know, the phrase that the UK government uses, for example, is normalization of relationship with China, a closer engagement. Well, how can we normalize relationships if my father is still in prison in Hong Kong? This is a man who has stood up for the best of the freedoms that unites us as democracies. A man who at every turn decided to do what was right, what was courageous. We're never going to normalize what is happening to him. That's completely unacceptable. And if they can't even put a 78-year-old man on a plane and send him back to the United Kingdom, to the US, then it's very telling of the relationship going forward, of what they think of the relationship. And
a British citizen.
And I honestly think,
underscore that. Your father's a British citizen.
Yeah. He's only a British citizen. He doesn't have any other citizenship. He's not a Chinese citizen. It's also worth noting that this is a relatively simple thing for China to do, for Hong Kong and China to do, in the sense of it will take them 2 hours to put him on a plane and send him back, at not just zero cost, it would be directly beneficial to them as well. And look, I mean, every single person looking at this case sees the abuse of this old man. And I don't see how that's beneficial for China's reputation. I don't see how it's beneficial for Hong Kong's reputation. And I think Hong Kong has essentially done very badly by China in the persecution and cruelty that they have shown to my father.
Yeah, over a law that wasn't on the books. It was passed after the alleged actions by your father. I mean, that's the most galling thing. This judicial process was a total sham. But Sebastian, Secretary of State Marco Rubio has called for a humanitarian parole for Jimmy Lai, for your father. The British Foreign Secretary has also called this tantamount to a life sentence. Are we hearing enough from the British government? And what do you make of Starmer, the Prime Minister? He seems to have very warm relations with Xi at this point. Let me say this, Mr. Speaker.
Yeah, look, as I said before, the idea is that with warm relationship, these cases will be raised. Well, my father's case is the ultimate litmus test for UK and China Hong Kong relationships. This is something that if the Prime Minister can't bring one British citizen home, a man who again stood for so much of what makes, a democracy a democracy, courage, courage. If they can't even do that, then
Freedom of
again, it's
thought
very
and
telling of the
speech, too.
relationship. Yes. And how that looks like when someone's willing to defend those values until the very end. And still does to this day.
Are you hopeful the Trump meeting in April could bear fruit, that Trump could press Xi on this?
We've been so grateful of the support that we've had from the president. I think, look, he obviously, cares about the case, and I'd like to thank him from the bottom of my heart. He's given our family so much hope, and I think if there is a person who can do it, a master negotiator, a person who cares about freedom around the world, it would be him to do it. So I really hope that the president saves my father's life.
Father, so far this case has not gotten the media attention that, say, Nelson Mandela got. Why isn't this on the front burner of journalists and the media? And where is the Vatican? Is that China deal sealing their lips?
Well, let me start with the last question, because I think there's been a shift in the Vatican. I mean, the Holy Father has met with Claire and Teresa Lai, Mrs. Lai. And I have reason to believe that the Holy Father has given assurances of his prayers. And when you deal with diplomatic relations, these things go on behind the scenes. I think there's been a shift in the sense of the Vatican's relationship to Jimmy Lai. Then there's the question of the media in general. This is hard to understand when, and it's not unique, because there are many other things going on in the world right now where the media is not paying attention. The whole Iran thing, and what you see is this kind of bias of the establishment media. Jimmy Lai has made no secret of his advocacy of the free market. It's part and parcel of his whole advocacy of human freedom in general. And so, and then I don't know to what extent this plays a role in this, but he's a devout man. He's a Christian and a serious Christian convert. And I think that is what's sustaining him in prison right now, in defiance of the communist dictatorship.
Sebastian, are you surprised? We've been hearing all these Olympic athletes sound off on everything from ICE to Trump, using this international stage and platform. I was struck that no one raised the case of your father. If you want to talk about freedom, if you want to talk about democracy, if you want to talk about unity of peoples and purpose, where is that cause being raised?
I obviously wish that they did raise my father's case. Look, I think it's a case where if we talk about symbolism and heroism, it's got all the elements there. I mean, a lot of these athletes, Olympians, are seen as champions of their nations. Well, here is my father, a champion of democratic values, a man who has given so much for freedom and keeps giving so much for freedom, and in a incredible act of bravery, puts himself in front of his journalists to defend that freedom. And I think any athlete, or indeed any person who hears my father's story, can't help but be touched by that bravery. So I wish they did speak out for my father, and I'd be very grateful if they
No,
did.
They should be. They should be. And Father Sirico, very quickly, I know you came in contact with a listserv what Jimmy Lai has been reading in recent days in his confinement. And when you were mentioning this to me earlier, I kept thinking of Thomas More and our man we both knew, Cardinal Van Thuan of Vietnam, who was, also found himself in solitary and converted people. That deep sense of not only faith, but redemptive suffering. Tell me what he's reading there.
Yes. I've seen a partial list, and this is 133 books, and I don't mean light devotionals. I mean Augustine's City of God, the Summa Theologica, Romano Guardini. Some seminarians may not have read these things. Ratzinger, John Paul II, and as you mentioned, Francis Xavier Nguyen Van Thuan, who spent 13 years in a communist prison in Vietnam. Also, the prison journals of Cardinal Pell, who was unjustly confined in Australia until he was unanimously exonerated by their Supreme Court, and numerous other books. And this is what sustains him. You know, Raymond, we're talking about this on the eve of Lent, and I like to see this. I have no doubt that Jimmy is thinking something along these lines. We are about to enter the period of the church's retreat, of its silence, of the embrace of penance and suffering, so that the suffering of Christ that we identify ourselves with comes to be the thing that redeems the world, even in the face of Good Friday, which was the heart of darkness. And Jimmy is facing the heart of darkness right now, but Satan's pride comes to nothing on Easter Sunday. There is triumph. And I believe with all my heart that Jimmy has tasted that triumph already, one way or the other.
Sebastian, I want to give you the last word. Your father arrived in Hong Kong when he was 12 years old as a stowaway. He was hidden in the bottom of a fishing boat, dreaming of freedom. He built an empire, founded a newspaper, found a faith, and now is really pouring himself out into that faith and using it to sustain him. And he supported the people of Hong Kong. Now he sits in the cell in Beijing. Beijing says he was the mastermind of some conspiracy. I heard the silly Chinese global television referring to Jimmy Lai as the instigator of the anti-China riots when they gleefully announced his verdict. If your father could hear us tonight, if he could hear from our viewers, what would you want him to know?
That we're very proud of him. Many people in the world view him as a hero. But when people think of men like him, men who do these brave acts of courage, of continuous courage, they think of these men as men who have no fear. And that's not true. I know my father. I know that he fears just as anybody else does, to die alone, to never see his family again, to not be able to sleep his own bed for one last time. But what he has done is that he refuses to be intimidated by that fear. And I think in my father's story, you have a man who was called out by fate and by his faith. And he answered that call. And if he hears this one day, I just want him to know how incredibly proud of him I am for that.
Well, God bless you both. Sebastian Lai, Father Robert Sirico, I thank you both for being here. We will continue speaking about Jimmy, reporting on his case and his situation. And we remain hopeful and pray for his release. You can see the excellent documentary about Jimmy Lai, if you haven't, The Hong Konger, which Father Sirico had a hand in, at freejimmylai.com. Watch it, experience it, see who we're talking about. Thank you both. As regular viewers know, we've been covering the ongoing saga of the cause of Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen for decades. In full disclosure, I was a member of the original foundation that moved his cause for canonization over 20 years ago. The Vatican has announced this week that the cause of Venerable Archbishop Sheen can proceed. What does that mean for the church and a world that desperately needs the clarity and the passion that Fulton Sheen brought to the airwaves for decades? Here with the latest is Monsignor Jason Gray. He's the executive director of the Archbishop Fulton Sheen Foundation and a member of Archbishop Sheen's family, Rosemary Holliger Costello. Thank you both for being here. Delighted you could join us. The beatification date and the location, I know, have not been set as of yet, but I want to take our viewers, Monsignor, back a few years to 2019, because many people remember that moment when Pope Francis approved the miracle needed to move Archbishop Sheen's cause forward. The beatification was set for December 21st at the Cathedral of St. Mary in Peoria. And then 3 weeks before the ceremony, it was postponed by Bishop Maitano of Rochester. He asked the Vatican to delay it, not to relitigate the past, but take us through what happened there. Why did the Holy See agree to that request and place this cause in a 6-year holding pattern?
Well, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to be on. If you do go back to 2019, I'm sure that we can remember just how difficult a time that was. The church in New York was going through a number of different difficulties and obstacles, including investigations from the state, and Rochester itself was going through its own bankruptcy process. So it was really a very difficult time. And this is one of those moments where the events in New York would actually perhaps then cast a bit of a pall on the cause for Fulton Sheen. And it's really a shame if that were to happen. So we rejoice now that we can move forward with confidence that the Holy See has said this is the time. And we're very happy to do that. So we rejoice and celebrate with the church in New York, in Illinois, and throughout the world.
Yeah, it's a great moment. Rosemary, you had a unique relationship with Archbishop Sheen that goes well beyond just being cousins. I mean, you've said you owe your life to him because, well, tell us the story about how your mother, Yolanda, met your father who lived with Fulton Sheen. Tell us that story.
Well, for a time, my father did live with Bishop Sheen, and thank you for having me as well. My grandmother, my dad's mom, and the bishop were very close their whole lives. And so my father went to live with the bishop. He had graduated from Notre Dame, was in the Korean War. And my grandmother called the bishop and said, "I'm sending Tommy to you because he needs a job." And so my dad went and lived with the bishop, and the bishop did get him his first job. In the meantime, the bishop was doing Lenten talks at St. Aidan's in Jersey City, New Jersey, and my mother went every week to listen to him and gave him money for the propagation of the faith. And he pulled her out of the crowd one day and decided that he wanted to introduce her to my father, unbeknownst to my mother, of course. The bishop had this all planned. And he did just that at one of his telecasts, and then the rest is history, really.
Unbelievable. I mean, he even paid for the engagement ring, which I was delighted, and I guess helped pick out the wedding dress.
He did pay for the engagement ring, but my father paid him back. My grandfather did pay for the wedding gown, but the bishop was very much a part of choosing that gown with my mother, so he was a very big part of their lives starting out, and then continued to be up until his death. I'm the oldest of six. He gave us all our sacraments, was a frequent visitor at our home, and really was like a grandfather to us.
Yeah, I mean, he was literally Uncle Fulty to you, which was the moniker they attached to him, because Uncle Milty, whom he beat regularly in the ratings, they called him Uncle Fulty, and he was certainly that to you. Monsignor, now that the cause is back on track, I want to talk about why this matters now. Some might say, look, Fulton Sheen was great in the 50s and 60s in early television. What does he have to say to us today in 2026?
When the cause was opened, one of the comments that people made was that he's really only known to a certain generation that is getting older and older because they're the ones that remember him on television. But it's really not true to say that that's the only place that matters, because lots of younger people have been discovering Sheen as well. And I think when they see someone who is a person of such integrity and with such clarity of vision and such a strong faith, he is the type of person that continues to move people even today. So we've had a little pause in the cause, but I think it's actually only made Sheen stronger. This is actually served to elevate the attention that's come to Fulton Sheen. So more and more people, I think, can appreciate it now at this time.
Yeah, I'll tell you quickly my personal connection and why I joined the foundation all those years ago. When I was a Cub reporter working for another network, I was dating a girl who was not Catholic, and I interviewed a priest, and he said, "Wait a minute here," and he brought me a box of Fulton Sheen's cassette tapes for converts. It was his whole convert class, like 30 tapes, 40 tapes, and he handed it to me. He said, "Give this to your girlfriend and go downtown and make a deal with Fulton Sheen at St. Patrick's Cathedral." I thought, how do I do that? But he said, go offer him something in exchange for his help in converting your girlfriend. So I went down, and the promise I made to him was, and I had just started in television, that if he helped convert my Rebecca, that I would get him back on television or work to do that. And when I came to EWTN a few years later, we did a documentary on him, and it went over so well with the man who owned the rights that he gave EWTN the rights, or allowed them to air Fulton Sheen's show every week after my show, The World Over. So that's kind of my little role in this drama and how I feel so attached to him. He was just an incredible voice, such clarity. And, you know, and he delivered. He delivered. Sheena's 30 million viewers, you know, at the peak of his career when Life Was Worth Living was on TV. In today's media landscape, Monsignor, that seems almost unimaginable. But he wasn't just quoting theology. He was talking about psychology and politics, sociology, the arts. He was really doing it with a personal passion. And as you mentioned, that personal relationship with Jesus really came through. What does the church gain by raising him now to the altars?
Well, he's the most effective evangelist and media figure that the Catholic Church has had in the United States. So this is a tremendous contribution that he has. It also is something that's very inspiring because Catholic media today is so important. And so he can really be a model and a patron for those things. But also it was more than just that he was good on television. And he was. It was more than just that he was telegenic. And he was, and charismatic.
Right.
But behind that was actually a very deep faith, a personal relationship with Jesus Christ that came out in particular from his daily Eucharistic Holy Hour. And that's, I think that's probably as much as anything. He was so educated. He had so many degrees as part of his background. And yet he was still always able to communicate to just the common person, to make the gospel understood and to draw people in, Catholics, Protestants, and Jews. He had a very wide and diverse audience. So it's hard to find anyone who's like him today.
Rosemary, your mother, Yolanda, appeared in a 2011 documentary about Archbishop Sheen. She taught him the organ when he was learning the instrument.
Yes.
Now, the world knew this Emmy-winning broadcaster, but he was a relative to you. What would people be surprised about the personal side of Sheen that they didn't see on TV?
Well, you know, he didn't seem like a movie star or, you know, anybody famous to us. We knew he was on TV, we would see him, but he was just, you know, a wonderful family member, really like a grandfather to us in so many ways. And so just, he had the qualities that anyone, any of us that have a relative that we love, he had those qualities. He loved to be with us. He read stories to us. He taught us to recite the poem, Lovely Lady Dressed in Blue, which was his favorite poem. And we had to practice it before he came because he always quizzed us because he always wanted us to be able to say that. But, and, you know, we played the piano for him. We had just everything that we would do for any loving family member. Really, that's who he was to us most of all. But on top of that, we always sensed his genuine holiness. And when you're with somebody that is truly holy, it's ineffable, but you feel that. And that truly is how we always felt with him, which is why we did know that and felt that he would be a saint someday.
Huh. Monsignor, you know better than anyone that there's been this surge of devotion in Sheen. I mean, I've seen it, you know, in my professional life from the audience over many years. You've documented increased visits to the tomb in Peoria, requests for relics, reports of favors and graces. Tell us about what you're seeing now and why the young are so drawn to Archbishop Sheen, do you think, and his message?
We've had an increasing number of people who had come to the tomb, so to see the place where Sheen was buried, and also to a museum where we have collected all sorts of memorabilia that are connected to Sheen's life. And that number has gone up even during COVID. Even during the COVID year, we actually still had a year-over-year increase in the number of people that came. And in addition to that, I would say the miracles that have been reported, we actually have several that may actually work toward canonization. So not only are we happy to get to beatification, but maybe, who knows, we might even get to canonization sooner than we think. But for young people, I think young people do gravitate toward this in particular, because Sheen was someone who spoke to the culture and the world in which he lived. And he had an enduring message, whereas so oftentimes the world falls short. And I think if there's one thing that young people sense, whether they can figure it out or not, is that the message that the world offers to them oftentimes is so empty and does not lead to happiness. It doesn't make life worth living. But Sheen can offer something that the world can't offer. And I think that's the thing that makes it so powerful, Sheen's witness to the young people.
You talked about the next step here, the canonization. I mean, that requires a second miracle, and you conducted the investigation into the first miracle, a stillborn child, James Fulton Eggstrom, who I remember interviewing his parents years ago, and he revived after 61 minutes without a heartbeat. But here's what people may not know. Because Pope Francis had already ordered the beatification in 2019, any miracles attributed to Sheen's intercession after that date can be, I imagine, investigated for the canonization, right, Monsignor? Are you aware of any new cases of alleged miracles?
Oh, sure. Sure. We have, so typically the miracle for canonization has to follow the beatification, but it's a small detail, but once the beatification has been ordered, it is permissible to present miracles that have taken place since that time. Usually it's not a big deal because those two events are not very far apart, but in this case, they've been separated by 6 years. So there have been since 2019, a number of different miracles. We actually have five that have been reported to us. We're in the early stages of looking into them. We have to investigate them, check them out with doctors who can say that it does meet the criteria of being truly beyond any natural explanation. Then if so, we'll pick the best one that we can find. Just as with the Engstrom miracle, we actually had several to choose from there, and we picked James Fulton because we thought that was the best miracle, and indeed it was. So we looked for picking one of these other ones that really is superlative, and hopefully we can submit that and have that move forward for canonization soon.
Yeah. Rosemary, your family, I know, has been praying to your cousin, your great uncle, and through him for many years now. Have you experienced his intercession in your own life? And what would you say to someone watching who might be hesitant to ask for the intercession of someone who isn't yet canonized?
Well, I certainly have experienced his intercession. I have prayed to him just for little things to intercede for me. But a big thing that Ed, that I feel that his intercession has come through for us in a very big way for my sister Maureen, who has stage 4 breast cancer. And we have talked to Sister Leah Stefankova and about her. She was 5 years, her cancer was progressing, and they put her on a clinical trial, which in fact, we just found out on December 9th of this year, after the Mass at St. Agnes that Monsignor Gray and I were both at, that my sister was actually on a placebo for those 5 years while the cancer was progressing. And so she is in the, and we always felt she was a miracle anyway, because she was doing so well, but we had no idea that she actually had no medical intervention and the cancer has gone away. So she is in the process of submitting medical documentation for that. And even if it doesn't get to the Vatican, we believe that Bishop Sheen did intercede on our behalf for our sister. And but for so many other people, my mother used to hand out his prayer cards all the time. Anyone who was, you know, especially a difficulty with their health, we always prayed and we always felt a special prayer to our bishop. We knew that he would do everything he could to intercede on our behalf. And we certainly believe that has happened.
Monsignor, what has this moment, and I know you've been waiting for it for so long, what has this announcement from Rome announcing the continuation of the Sheen cause, what has it meant to you personally?
Well, this is something that's certainly been long awaited. It's a validation of something that's been a conviction of mine for a very long time. Having gotten to know Sheen and gone through the all the investigation about his heroic virtue, so I knew that this was a true man of God and someone worthy of veneration. And with the powerful miracle that we have, and I guess we need to now add a sixth miracle that we've just talked about here on the show, so we have even one more now to discuss. But because of that powerful miracle for beatification and Sheen's personal witness, and I know his integrity, which has really been proven out, I was convinced that the beatification would happen. It was just a question of time. We can really say that Sheen has emerged all the stronger because no one has been more investigated in any process of beatification and canonization than Sheen. He's gone through the Vatican investigation, which is extraordinarily thorough. And then on top of that, additional scrutiny that's been applied even in these last years. And so it really just proves truly the worthiness of someone like Fulton Sheen to be raised to that title of blessed.
Yeah. Well, look, it's a moment, as you said at the beginning, of celebration. Rosemary, I know your family must be ecstatic over this.
We are ecstatic, but truly just so very grateful. We've been praying for it for so long. And my mother always said Bishop Sheehan will be a saint someday, and we truly believed it, and we continue to pray for that. But right now we're taking blessed, and then hopefully we'll go on to Canada. Yes, correct. But then hopefully canonization soon thereafter.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we'll pray for that. And I ask both of you to remember me to the new blessed. He has a special place in my heart and certainly has been one of the guiding lights in my career. And I know Mother Angelica also was, inspired by Fulton Sheen in so many ways. So thank you both for being here. Monsignor Jason Gray, Rosemary Holliger Costello, I thank you both for being here. For more on the Archbishop Sheen Foundation, the Sheen cause for canonization, all the info, you can go to CelebrateSheen.com. Thank you all. It's an alarming trend. 400 acts of vandalism, arson, and violence against churches and houses of worship just last year alone. We've seen Catholic sanctuaries desecrated, statues destroyed, bomb threats, even shootings. She is the Assistant Attorney General of Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Justice and has led investigations and prosecutions to protect religious freedom for people of all faiths in the United States. Welcome back to the program, Harmeet Dhillon. Harmeet, thank you for being here. The Family Research Council identified 415 hostile incidents in 2024 against a total of something like nearly 400 churches. Vandalism, arson, gun-related incidents, bomb threats, that's down slightly from 485 the year before. But when you look at 2018, there were only 50 incidents of this type. What do you make of this dramatic surge? What do you think is driving this?
Well, thanks for having me, Raymond. It is very concerning to see this rise in violence against people of faith, but I also think we're seeing more awareness of it. And I think that in part, people are reporting these incidents more, at least to the federal government, because they see that we're actually doing something about them. So I would say that this Department of Justice, and particularly the Civil Rights Division, is probably the most proactive in terms of protecting people of faith and houses of worship compared to any in United States history. And so just so far in less than a year in office, I prosecuted numerous incidents of attacks on churches and synagogues and houses of worship in general, but we've also had civil cases involving these kinds of attacks. We have many open investigations as well. And we've seen many plea agreements and convictions in a Mormon church attack recently. There was an arson attack on a synagogue in Mississippi. We've convicted a guy who left backpacks in churches in Colorado, Arizona, and California. We convicted a Kentucky man for attacking and decapitating a statue of the Virgin Mary, and many other cases like this. And so you've seen, of course, the news about the obstruction of the city's church in Minnesota, and at least one of the individuals in that case has been accused of interfering with other religious observances of Christians here in the Capitol. So we're on this. It's one of our top priorities here at the DOJ.
I want to talk about that case of that Florida teenager recently. He had a plot to attack a church and was discovered before he carried it out. Investigators linked the teen to a neo-Nazi satanic group. Harmeet, without jeopardizing any ongoing investigations, what have you discovered in the DOJ's investigation so far that is fueling this? What's the primary thing fueling these religious attacks? Is it social media? Is it the conflagration of politics overlaid on top of people of faith and they think this is somehow a political protest?
Well, I don't have the answers to all of that, but some patterns that I can see, just as anybody can observe with their own eyes. For one thing, we've seen an increase in violence by young people who are identifying as transgender. I think there are some questions about what's the cause and what's the effect there. Are they alienated and then do they become transgender and also become violent? Are the drugs a factor? I'm not here to opine on the root causes, but I do see some patterns like that. I also see a rise in anti-Semitism generally on campuses and against synagogues. And I think some of that may be fueled from foreign sources and organized efforts to destabilize. And then in terms of the Christian rise of violence against houses of worship and other incidents of that nature, generally speaking, I think our society is becoming more secular. I don't think people who regularly go to church are, you know, showing up and saying, hands up, don't shoot, and who shut this down, we shut this down. I mean, that's generally not something that people of faith are doing. So I think that that is part of it as well. And you know, I think we would all behoove ourselves to return to some of our roots on which this country was founded, including religious liberty and belief in God.
Yeah. Harmeet, Don Lemon, the independent journalist fired by CNN in 2023, he had been documenting that Minnesota chaos following the fatal ICE shooting of Renee Nicole Good. And last month, as you well know, he entered that city's church in St. Paul along with anti-ICE agitators. He began filming, telling viewers that, quote, the freedom to protest is what the First Amendment is all about. Harmeet, I know you're investigating potential criminal violations of a federal law in this case. It's notable that the anti-ICE agitators are now claiming they're journalists to protect against prosecution. Is everybody a journalist now?
Well, in a way, everybody can be a journalist. I suppose we're all journalists on X if we're posting and we're uncovering things and we're just being empirical about it. But I think the important thing for your viewers to understand is, one, first of all, we've arrested 9 people so far. A third of them claim to be journalists and are identified as such by Nkema Armstrong, the lawyer who organized this this attack on this church. And I'm not even counting the person who drove Don Lemon or his camera guy as journalists. But if you add those, then more than half of them are claiming to be journalists.
Does the free speech right obliterate the other right to free worship?
No, and that was my bigger point is journalists commit crimes as well. You know, it's not a shield against prosecution that you are wearing a journalism badge or you're taking it on and putting it off. I mean, notably, when you look at the video that Don Lemon himself put out there, he outside the church, he has a big stick mic and he's putting it, you know, he's interviewing his co-conspirators or his alleged co-conspirators. He then changes, he puts on a disguise, if you will. He puts on a hoodie, takes off that microphone, puts on a small lapel mic and with a lav, and he's like, he doesn't want to alert them because he's so famous, of course, that if he goes in as Don Lemon journalist, you know, that's going to completely change the character of this event. So he goes in disguise, if you will, and then springs it on them and say, I don't know, everyone, the jury is eventually going to decide whether that protects you against the federal civil rights allegations in this case, including but not limited to the Klan Act and the FACE Act. But, you know, in prior incidents, the United States Department of Justice has prosecuted people who claim to be journalists or even, let's call them, podcasters of the nature of Don Lemon today in multiple incidents, and including anti-abortion protests and what have you. If calling yourself a journalist is a shield to federal criminal liability, then everyone is going to call themselves a journalist, and then we have to get into semantics of what that is. I'm not getting into that. I don't think it matters. You could be a journalist, but if you cross the line, you'll pay for the crime.
Yeah, well, at the heart of this case is the FACE Act. Explain to people what that is and how the Biden Department of Justice sort of weaponized that FACE Act.
The FACE Act was passed in 1994. It's a Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act. And that's the main purpose of it originally was to protect abortion clinics from mainly Christian protesters. And to get it to pass, the sponsors of this legislation added in a provision that also protects houses of worship from similar types of obstruction and attack. And it's never been used for that until this administration, because, you know, mainly it's been weaponized by Democrat administrations against Christian pro-life protesters. Now, during the Biden administration, they actually went after many of these people, and not only with the FACE Act, which your initial violation of which is a misdemeanor, so fairly minor punishment, but when you add a conspiracy charge to that, it can become a felony. And so if you have two or more people praying outside a abortion clinic and they are alleged to have blocked the entrance or intimidated women seeking abortions, then they were prosecuted and given some very heavy penalties, years in prison. Now, the Biden DOJ did also go after a handful of protesters after the Dobbs decision came out, and they were crisis pregnancy centers. So there was one case like that, Ora Pesa versus United States. And similarly, the pro-abortion protesters, in that case, Jane's Revenge, were prosecuted. And they were also prosecuted under the Klan Act, the conspiracy statute. And I actually defended that conviction. And we won that in the 11th Circuit. And so that is the law. You can use the FACE Act and you can apply conspiracy enhancements and you can convict someone of a felony for doing this. No one ever did it vis-a-vis houses of worship. But I will also say we didn't see a lot of so-called protesters invading churches until the recent vogue about ICE. Thank goodness. I mean, even that was off limits to the wacky left until this last year. And now suddenly I'm very concerned. And one reason we moved very quickly in this case is, first of all, we don't want to see people of faith being deterred from going to church by this type of you know, nearly, it's quite very alarming activity, particularly in an area where there was a fatal shooting incident in a Catholic church in Minneapolis just a few months ago. And so people thought they were under attack. And then secondly, if this becomes acceptable in the United States, we are going to see neo-Nazis doing this in synagogues. We're going to see anti-Muslim protesters doing this in mosques and so forth. And this is just un-American and antithetical to what we believe in as a country. Yeah. It's also against some state laws as well. And so, you know, we're pleased to see that state prosecutors are also going after some of these offenses as well.
Well, look, I know you can't comment on ongoing investigations, but I have to mention this. I know our viewers are very concerned about it. In early February, Holy Innocents Catholic Church and School in Long Beach, California was desecrated. Statues smashed, images of the Virgin Mary destroyed, the tabernacle was cracked open, chapel vandalized. This incident, along with what we're seeing in Minnesota and other parts of the country, I think do deeply worry people. What can you tell us about the priorities of the DOJ in prosecuting these cases? And is the message being conveyed that you all are on the case?
Well, I think the Don Lemon arrest, you know, from both sides got certainly days of attention. I think it's a very high priority of ours. From day one, I'm certainly, as you know, from before I took this job on, a lawyer who has made the protection of people of faith a central part of my law practice for over three decades now. And so it's very important to me. It's very important to the Attorney General, and it's very important to our president. So no one has told me anything other than pedal to the metal on this. We have a team of prosecutors dedicated to these FACE Act investigations and cases. We have dedicated law enforcement who work with us, United States Attorney's offices we coordinate with regularly. We have put some people away in the last several months who attacked houses of worship and attacked people of faith on the streets of different cities. And so I don't think there's a higher priority. And if we lose our ability to peacefully go to our house of worship on a Saturday, Sunday, or whatever day you pray, or feel like our sanctuaries are not safe, people will stop going to church, which would be it was something I fought against and won three cases at the United States Supreme Court between myself and others working with my nonprofit at that time, that the relegation of faith to like some optional thing that you can be forced to do by Zoom was deeply offensive to me and many people of faith in this country. We fought against that all the way to the Supreme Court. And this Supreme Court has now put faith back in its rightful place in the pantheon of First Amendment rights where it belongs, which is equal, if not superior, to all of those.
Yeah. Harmeet, are you getting support from the faith leaders, the Catholic bishops, the evangelical church? Or are they sort of sitting this one out, even though all of these cases affect them? And frankly, it puts them in the target here.
Well, look, I mean, I get a pat on the back whenever I encounter them, but most of the time I'm not running around seeking kudos. You know, we are out there doing our jobs. I've spent many weekends flying to different cities to make sure that we tour synagogues or other places of worship where they have been attacked on their days that they congregate so that the congregation sees that the United States Department of Justice is a partner of theirs. I speak regularly. Earlier this week, I spoke at George Washington University's conference on extremism, which was focusing this year on anti-Semitism. And we are just really out there making sure that everyone knows. I've got several speeches lined up in front of different denominations of Christian groups. I speak regularly to pastors. I meet with any person of faith or faith leader who wants to come here and meet with us in the Department of Justice to hear their concerns. And their concerns are not just the obvious ones that have been raised here, but people who are imprisoned also have rights. And so if anybody's in a prison facility and they're not being allowed to pray in their faith within reason, of course, and consistent with carceral priorities, we step in and we inquire and we make sure that they're taken care of. When women are being forced to disrobe in front of men in these prisons, I mean, that's another faith issue. Teenagers are also entitled to their faith beliefs being protected. So in Loudoun County, Virginia, we've stepped in to side with two boys who have raised religious objections to a girl coming into their locker room and and invading their privacy. And boys have rights too. So anywhere we see violations of faith that we believe are protected by federal law, we step in, we open investigations, and if necessary, we seek convictions or civil penalties.
Well, Armeet, I hope this moment has clarified for a lot of leaders, Catholic leaders and otherwise, to support you in this. I think it's important for the faith community to say, wait a minute, we all need to also support the vigorous prosecutions and investigations that this Department of Justice and this Civil Rights Division is willing to enact on our behalf. And I don't hear enough of that, and maybe that has to be, you all need that support, I think, just to activate the people in the pews so they realize what's at stake and what you're doing. Harmeet Dhillon, I thank you for your time, your clarity, and your work, and we'll check in with you soon.
Thanks a lot, Raymond. Take care.
There's a remarkable production opening next week in the U.S. We alluded to it last week, Bernadette the Musical. And it's not your typical story of a saint. I spoke with the director, Serge Denoncourt, and co-producer, Pierre Ferragut. Now, this week, I'll bring you some of my conversation with Hollywood legend Kelsey Grammer, who signed on to Bernadette as a co-lead producer. I didn't realize he'd produced other shows on Broadway. The show premieres February 19th in Chicago, but it's running in previews. Kelsey told me Bernadette, the musical, was such a unique and personal project for him. Take a look. Just to bring all of this full circle, you produced The Color Purple, won a Tony
Award
I was
one
for
of
it.
Yeah.
I know you were one of them. One of the many esteemed people who produced
yes.
The Color Purple. But you do have credentials in the producing space.
Mm-hmm.
You recently saw this musical, Bernadette.
Right.
What did you think when you saw it?
It's an extraordinary thing. I mean, it's this young woman is, it's like a visit with Saint Bernadette. I mean, for whatever reason, they found this magnificent young woman. But so did Saint Bernadette.
Exactly.
It's like they are walking along together, and it's remarkable. And you feel like you're looking right into her eyes from, the back of the house. I mean, it's something. So,
did you feel Karen when you watched it the first time? Because that's what occurred to me as I read.
Interesting. That's an interesting thought. Not necessarily. This was it's specific unto itself.
Mm-hmm.
That this saint is. She's remarkable and still remarkable. Apparently, I mean, she's un whatever. I guess I don't know what they call that when the corpse doesn't rot.
I mean, incorruptible.
She's that.
She's still incorruptible.
I mean, that's,
have you seen the body?
No, I haven't, but I've seen pictures.
Oh.
I was like, you got to be kidding. I mean, it's like, so there is,
I mean, the Lourdes.
This ain't Lennon's tomb. This is the real deal.
Exactly. This isn't the waxworks.
Yeah.
Have you been to Lourdes?
I have not.
Wow.
I've only been in France twice, and for film stuff.
Being a producer,
we're gonna
on
go
this,
and
you
see
have
this
to
stuff.
Go to Lourdes. But for those who don't know, for those who might be unaware, this is a 14-year-old girl receives this message from this lady, the Virgin Mary, and she's tortured over this truth that she has to witness to. How and why did that resonate with you, Kelsey, at this point in your life?
What resonated with me for this particular show is this young woman's performance is extraordinary, but also the resolve and the innocence and the simple beauty of just claiming who you are and stating clearly, I'm not lying.
Yeah.
You can tell me I am, but yeah. I'm not. I'm not going to change my story based upon whatever you throw at me. I'm steadfast, as was, I've been reminded by some of my co-producers of, yeah. of a word I said about her some time ago. Huh. Steadfast in her belief, yeah. in her faith, and in herself, in her own stature. This barely young woman stands in the face of all kinds of things and doesn't even resist, really, just says, this is the truth.
Yeah.
And that's remarkable.
It's the life I live, so why me? I have nothing to give.
Bernadette, the musical, premieres on February 19th. Previews begin this week on February 12th at the Athenaeum Center in Chicago, Illinois, before starting its national run across the U.S. For tickets and showtimes in Chicago and all the other stops, visit BernadetteTheMusical.com. And you can watch my full interview with Kelsey Grammer on the Arroyo Grande Show podcast. That's at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast. That's all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.